Hey there, loyal listeners. As you know, the Top Games podcast is made possible by Hardcore Gaming 101's Patreon supporters, who help keep this show alive by donating as little as $2 each month. If you were to join them in doing that, you would not only help keep the lights on at HG 101 Towers, you'd also get access to our super secret Patreon RSS feed, which is full of ad-free versions of this podcast with exclusive bonus game rankings. Here's a taste of what you've been missing. We're talking Plague Attack for the Atari Video Computer System. It takes place in a human mouth. You're like a militant tube of toothpaste in a gigantic hell mouth full of molars. The incoming enemies, which are like, you know, candy canes and hamburgers, hot dogs, ice cream cones, etc.
I think if you get 35,000 points, you can send away to Activision and join the Plaque Defender Squad or something. They'll send you
an actual patch you can sew on your clothes, don't they?
What kids like came to school with like their like Activision patches on that didn't just get immediately just like bullied within an inch of their lives? Like,
I'm a member of the Plaque Defender Squadron.
Go to patreon.com/HG101 and pledge a couple bucks. That's patreon.com/HG101. Act now and be a hero.
Some, this is painfully obvious, but hardcore gaming means it ain't for the novices. The main source to brain train your knowledge, you'll lay maintained with a course aimed at colleges. To HG101, we give the honor, thanks to Kirk Alada, Xerxes, the host of Proper, as well as Satanga, Cal and Bobinator, Ogre Hart and others. Discuss and discover all the 47,000 games, and when they rate them, you can bet it's scientifically locked in position. Speaking of which, no system is obscure, and look, they wrote a book about it, go out and cop yours.
Hello and welcome to HardcoreGaming101.net's Top 47,858 Games of All Time podcast, where we objectively, definitively, and scientifically rank the games that you nominate. My name is Xerxes, and I'm the show's main host and producer, and on this podcast we have three rules. Rule 1, all rankings are final, official, and scientifically accurate. Rule 2, you can nominate one game at a time via 5-star review on iTunes or Stitcher. Those are the ones we try to get to first. You can also go to bit.ly/rankthisplease. And add a game to the slush pile and cross your fingers. We make no guarantees on those. Rule number 3, you can nominate games that have already been nominated, just don't nominate games you've already ranked. See the master list for yourself. It's at bit.ly/47kgames. That's bit.ly/47kgames.
Dogs Bower. Hey, Dogs Bower. Hey, Dogs Bower. Hey, Dogs Bower.
You must be with Tim.
Welcome back, everyone, to HG101's Top 47,858 Games of All Time. And in this episode, we're going to talk about Myth, History in the Making. It was nominated to us by Landama on Stitcher. It was developed by System 3, published by System 3, and originally released for the Commodore 64 in 1989, and then ported to a ton of systems later. And with me to talk about this game R, and my name is Tackalbit, by the way.
And I'm with Bob Hader.
And I'm Carl, and we are making history right here with a Commodore 64 game. Sure, why not? It's great, great game to be talking about. Myth, not the Bungie one. We gotta make this clear. We gotta...
People think it's the Bungie one. There's no subtitle in the Bungie one.
No, it's just called Myth, and it's completely different in literally every way. This is a cinematic platformer in all but kind of, well, really all but because that genre didn't technically exist yet, maybe. When was Prince of Persia? Was that before this one? It probably was, actually. Actually, was it?
I'm pretty sure Prince of Persia is older than this.
Yeah, so, I don't know, like, this one, it's pretty dang cool. It is a side-scrolling platformer with a surprisingly large amount of puzzle elements. It's actually a really tough one to pin down. Always surprised when I played this one how many things it has going on. Tax, you are familiar with this one, though. Do you want
to... I am familiar with this one. And just to go back to Prince of Persia for a brief moment, Prince of Persia apparently came out on the 3rd of October 1989. So the same year. So Myth could have been a release before this. It's not quite clear because we don't have a definitive release date.
Okay, so
but
we are
they came out around the same time.
Yeah, so they're simultaneous, but they're not actually.
Exactly, yeah. I'm pretty sure they were co-developed. I doubt that any studio took that inspiration from the respective other game. The idea behind Myth History in the Making is that you take the role of a young man whose goal is to go through time or various time periods or mythological variants thereof and stop an evil entity from taking over the universe. And to do that, you have to beat up various mythological creatures, step some people, do a lot of platforming, all of which is very cinematic, as alluded to.
I wouldn't say it's as cinematic as something like Prince of Persia. You can't climb on things. You move a little more slowly, and your jump's a little bit different from most platformers, but that's about it.
Well, the main reason that makes me say that is it's not about specifically just overcoming a set of enemies. There are actually several specific pseudo-puzzle things, and there is inventory to consider, which is not a staple of platformers. It kind of lends this more ordered, almost point-and-click kind of thing. Or I guess it probably is more informed by maybe the Dizzy games or something like that, where you do have these specific items that you have to get your hands on and then activate at particular times. The difference being this one constantly sends enemies at you, like some sort of ghouls and ghostish sort of thing, where you're just dogpiled constantly.
Yeah, in fact, I found it to be most efficient to avoid all of them. The only exception are really enemies you have to fight in some situations, and there's usually a weaker type of enemy in every stage. In the first stage, that's the ancient Greece stage, you have like green demons that fly at you, but they die in one hit even if you just use your fists, and they occasionally drop health, and there's a similar little green dragon type in the later Viking Age or mythological North stage. It's worth killing those because they do drop stuff. But other things like the skeletons, that's the second enemy in the first stage. If you have your fists, good luck trying to kill a skeleton. It's not going to work out well. And even you have the sword, which you get shortly afterwards, they're kind of difficult to kill. They do have you have the advantage that they don't deal contact damage. They actually have to hit you with their weapons to damage you. But you also have to swing your sword. It takes a couple of frames. You can't really dodge their weapon unless you just step back, so you have to be a little bit careful about that. And because this is was originally a microcomputer game, the controls are somewhat limited. There aren't many buttons, so you essentially have to work with your joystick or your arrow keys and then kind of do everything else by pushing your action button and something else, which works somewhat well, but still means that fighting becomes a little bit fiddlier.
You'd be familiar with something like, International Karate, a way of the exploding fist. It's that you've got a bunch of inputs if you aren't holding a button, and a bunch of inputs if you are holding a button. And you've got to kind of figure that out. Like, for instance, I believe if you press down, you actually do a long forward jump.
You do. That is actually surprisingly useful, because you don't have to gain any momentum. You just push a button and you immediately jump in a very specific arc. And once you get used to that, it makes platforming a lot easier because you don't need to press anything else. You don't need to press left or right. Just push the button. You do this very specific distance. It works every time. I found that a bit weird initially because I thought, why do I need that? I have regular jumping. But it's surprisingly useful.
Yeah. I mean, the game, such as it is weird because you actually, it's not a one-shot through game. You actually have to go and do a thing to then do other things, which is quite unusual for a platformer on the Commodore 64 in this case. I believe you have to, release a barrel of bones to get the sword or something? You have to go fight a specific skeleton after getting fireball magic?
Yeah. Here's my thing with this game. There are a lot of very specific things you have to do to make progress, and you're never given hints on any of them.
That is correct.
And that basically just kills this game for me. I'm sorry. I am not the most clever person. I can't handle games like that.
And there's also randomness on top of what Bob just said. In fact, the very first time I played this, the following thing happened. I start. I kill one of those little green demons. I immediately get the flame and then kill a skeleton and then get the sword. They're like, wow, this works well. Then I die because inadvertently fall into one of the flame pits. Then I try it again, and then I have to grind for the flame for about 3 minutes.
Yeah, it does.
So by sheer coincidence, that worked out well for me, but occasionally it doesn't. The game will give you the weapons somewhat regularly, but it's not really clear that you need that. And what I didn't realize until I died is that if you don't have any other weapons, the skeletons are almost invincible. And it's not really clear what you're supposed to do, because it kind of incentivizes you to avoid them, but you can't do that because you need the sword, as you mentioned, to cut down the skeleton. And if you don't do that, you can't beat the Chimera at the end of the stage, because you need to throw a pitchfork at it, which in turn you get from a demon, which you can only kill if you have the sword. So there's just a very specific chain of things you need to do. And it's not really, it's one big room. It's not really free roaming, but just one big room. You can go wherever you want. And because enemies spawn all the time, you're not really incentivized to just hang around anywhere and explore, because they just gang up on you. So you probably want to get through the stage as quickly as possible. But you can't really do that because you need those items.
Yeah, I will mention, I think, I actually have a lot of trouble finding the original manual on the internet. I found the System 3 manual, which is the, I think it's that ridiculous Commodore 64 home console. Is that right? I think it is. You can get that manual. That actually has a pretty comprehensive guide to beating the first level in it.
I bet they added that after people complained that the game is impossible and the first room is just a dead end.
Like, I'll read a little bit of it to you. Continue your adventure by slaying enemies with a sword until you reach the feminine nymph. Approach her only when she beckons or when her hand is flat. Be very cautious, and once close enough, kneel down. This changes the nymph into an extra energy bead, vital for later stages of the game. Note, when she holds her hand up in front of you, move back again until she beckons you to again try and move in. That is the kind of level of nonsensical things the game expects you to kind of intuitively get. I believe if you do that
impossible.
Wrong, the nymph kills you, like, instantly, or attacks you. I can't remember exactly her response.
That is impossible to figure out if you don't know exactly what to do, because there's no hint to, as you mentioned, the game gives you no hints. And while you do that, what the manual doesn't mention is that there's a little demon spawning every 2 seconds, and you have to kill them. Otherwise,
yeah,
they kill you. So this is not... It's a little bit like a point-and-click adventure. You made that comparison earlier. Except in a point-and-click adventure, you would just hang out in the room. You would scan every pixel, scan it, and then combine every item with every other item. But you can't really do that here, because the game is trying to kill you every second you remain.
Yeah, so, I mean, and that's the thing. Like, as I mentioned with Dizzy... As cruel as the Dizzy games are, you are very rarely sort of put in a sort of high arcade game situation where you've got to beat up a bunch of enemies all at once while figuring out where you need to shove the umbrella and the lump of coal. Like, usually you can sort of just mope around and be like, okay, well, maybe that or maybe that, and you can kind of weigh up what you need to do. Whereas in this one, yeah, you just kind of get slowly beaten up. I will say that the health system is surprisingly generous. You're going to need all of your health, but you don't die instantly, and you actually have a reasonable amount of health. You can take quite a few hits before you'll see the game over screen, and you can get more health if you are willing to grind up and pray to the Metroid gods, because that's the same game kind of problem that I have there with that one. It does kind of hold out. It is a game that once you get used to what it's doing, it makes a little bit more sense. And I think most of the puzzles, the really tough ones, are early on, and they do kind of phone it in a little bit later on in the game. So if you manage to somehow get through the early part, you'll probably be clever enough to hash out their remaining puzzles. But on that note, the game is kind of crazy in terms of its graphical spectacle. It looks amazing for a Commodore 64 game.
That's true. Definitely. I really love that kind of chunky, very pixelated look a lot of the more later Commodore 64 games have. That is a art style I've always really liked.
So they realized that they kind of worked out what the strength of the Commodore 64 was, and so they acted on it, which I think is really nice. Like, it's all this... They use the weird tones and the off shades and stuff to actually make things on screen have depth and that sort of thing, and it looks really nice. This one, it's why one of the reasons that this game, which has a ZX port and a NES port, neither of them look nearly as good as this one. even the CPC port, which often would at least kind of look a little bit more bright and colorful due to its resolution, it cannot keep up. This game is 100%, the C64 version is by far the best, easily, in terms of graphical spectacle. And there's some really awesome stuff, almost impossible to see or get to, because you have to get, like, halfway through the game, but there is this phenomenal stage on a Viking boat where it's pitch black and it is just illuminated by lightning. So it'll be like a crack of lightning and the whole stage will fade in and fade out with this like blast of lightning, and you're fighting, I think it's axe-wielding Vikings on a ship, and it looks tremendously good. It's something that you just look up a video. I'm not going to make you play the game, but it's pretty cool, and it keeps going even to the point where they get towards the end and they're like, I like R-Type, let's make this a shmup now. And it does. It's literally like the last stage is a shmup.
It is. It's also worth noting that they barely recycle any assets.
That's
almost
right.
Every room has unique assets in unique colors. There's generally one very heavy color, the initial caves, they're kind of reddish with a black background. The Viking statue mentioned is pretty black and white. And the other Viking stage, the second one, is like a blue sky. It's like green platforms. And there's a lot of unique enemies as well. There are some bosses. Well, there's comparably few bosses you straight up fight. There's a couple of them where you just walk up to them and stab them until they die. But there's a fair amount where you just need a specific item, like the Chimera. You just need to stab it with the pitchfork, but you don't really fight it. You just use the item on it. And there's also Medusa. And you have to deflect Medusa's I-beam with your shield.
Which you have to get by destroying the statue of Achilles by attacking its ankle. And that's,
yeah, exactly.
I'm just going to say that because you will never freaking figure that out. You will.
Well, if you've read the Ilias, which is obviously required before you play this game, then you would know.
Yeah, I would also know that was a statue of Achilles. Like, I would put that together. I would know that that's not a random statue of a hoplite. I would be like, oh, that's Achilles right there, definitely. There's no question. And yeah, once you get the shield, then you can. If you sequence break anything, if you miss any item, you die. Like, oh, I'm just going to say it right there. Like, if you end up where you need to be without the item you need, you're dead. That's it. Game over. You're doomed. You can't possibly win. It's all. If you try and fight the Chimera without the trident, you lose. If you throw the trident and miss, you lose. I don't know how you'd miss, but don't do that. And yeah, like, that's the way the game works, really. I don't know, it's one of those things that just assumes that you are a child or are the developer, essentially, and basically will literally try everything for days and days and days or already know the solution. There is more or less no middle ground at all there. Just dang, you know? It doesn't have music in-game, right? This one has one of the best loader tunes on the system.
Sort of. The final stage, the smup stage, has another song. But apart from that, it's just sound effects and new music.
Yeah, so a little bit of a shame, because as I said, the loader music in this game was by 17-year-old, I gotta say a 17-year-old like boy at this point, because he's just a lad and is better at music than I will literally ever be. Put together one of the most notable tunes, I think, on the C64. It's an epic song. It's just...
Drone Tell, right? That's his name?
Yes, it's yeah, Jerome Tell.
I really love his stuff. He does some of my favorite music on the system. Like, look up RoboCop 3 on the comics before. That has some terrific music.
Is that the one that they eventually used for the ad in,
No, that's something else.
That's the Game Boy game, is it?
That is not the one they use with, like, the Washington Terminal.
The Washington Machine ads. I like that. But no, RoboCop, it's good music. But definitely check out the music, because it's an epic tune. Like, it's the game is called Myth, and the music that they've made for it sounds pretty much exactly as it should. It's like, wow, you're totally getting ready for an amazing ass game. For me personally, this was a really weird thing, because the Cracker group, Razer, is it 1911? Is that their name? I don't remember their exact name. I mean, Razer, they actually used the Myth music in some of their cracktros. So when I eventually loaded this game up years after I was pirating software, this music started playing and I was just like, what the hell? Why do I know this? And I was briefly really confused until I kind of tracked down where the music was, where I had previously heard the song. So got a completely different experience there.
I didn't even know that. It's worth noting that that is actually a proper song in the sense that it's not just a 30-second loop. I think it's like a 4.5-minute song.
I mean, if YouTube probably... is to go by, you are almost exactly on the money. It says 4 minutes and 26 seconds on the video I loaded up just to double-check that the song was as good as I remembered.
It is, yeah. And another thing, I mean, we've mentioned that the game is a little bit unfair and can be a bit grueling, but it does reward you with a couple of cool things. When you cut off Medusa's head, you get her head as an item, and you can shoot her petrification beams. That's pretty neat. You can do a similar thing in the pyramid where you get the Pharaoh's Nemesis headgear, and then you can shoot lasers from that to incinerate mummies. That's also sweet. So the game gives you a couple of different toys, and they change up quite often, so you do get something new pretty much in every room. So as difficult as it is, at least the game keeps you busy. It's not repetitive.
No, like, it's...
Even the room design as such varies quite a bit. The first stage is a fair amount of platforming. There's a lot of platforming in the Viking stage, except for the first one, which is more just a linear beat-em-up-ish affair. So they did put a fair amount of variety in that game there. So you do get rewarded if you stick around.
It's one of the few Commodore 64 games where I would definitely say making it through it is actually rewarding on some level. It is basically impossible. It's really hard. Like, I don't think you can sell this short, like, how difficult it is to not only figure it out, but actually executing it, it is pretty tricky. Like, the enemies are quite savage.
Yeah, the difficulty felt kind of strange to me because you have a fairly long health bar, and it's not like that there are any individual platform sections that are really that difficult. It feels probably like, let's say, playing Super Mario Brothers with only one life and no continues. Yeah, the individual stages are still all quite manageable, but still complete the actual thing in one go is probably not something you're going to do anytime soon.
And you're probably going to hit, like, a basically dead-end yourself. At some point, you're going to overlook something.
That's very likely. I kind of want to know what this game's relationship with Prince of Persia is, because in some of the later stages, especially the pyramid stage, there's a lot of traps, and there's also traps with weight-dependent platforms you step on, which then triggers the traps. It feels very Prince of Persia-like, and it could be that they're just both inspired by some other, like, third-party work, but I would want to know where that came from, whether it was just, like, the spirit of the time, or just a coincidence.
I think it was Indiana Jones. Because that was quite a popular
That's a good
movie.
Point, yeah. That is a good point, yeah. It could be like maybe a Last Crusade with the temple and the trap floor and everything and swinging.
Yeah.
The swinging blade, because that's in this game as well. So maybe that's the inspiration for those games.
Yeah, I think you got like a lot of pop culture kind of stuff just coming in. The whole plot is insane, right? Like, it's just this really long story about, like, Vikings and gods and titans and basically someone really, like, I guess, like, Greek history or something, and just kind of jammed as much as they could into a game. You got to go to all these mythological eras. The manual describes it: Roman, Greek, Norse, Viking, and Egyptian, and then onwards towards the greatest challenge no mere mortal except this one could begin to contemplate: the final confrontation with Dameron. The boss is Dameron. He is a giant monster skull, as you would expect. It is pretty much
a really well drawn. They do really well at having these really big, massive sprites.
That's true.
Yeah, because they take advantage of the art style that they have decided to use, and it works really well. Love those big ass sprites. And there is some nice, like, movement. Like, I think the who do you fight with Medusa? Is it the Hydra?
You take Medusa's head, and then you fight the Hydra, or at least
it's got
some multi-headed dragon.
Yeah, like, you know, it's got the actual, like, segmented neck, so it actually, you know, its heads move a little bit. There's actual motion and stuff going on, which is, you know, always nice to see that kind of thing, rather than just a static lump of a boss, which is what some of them do.
Your character also has more than 2 frames of animation, so it looks fairly smooth. That's quite nice.
As I said, like, it is, like, the reason I got kind of stumbled around Prince of Persia is there is quite a lot of motion, you know, including in the enemies, like, some of the I'm going to call them hoplites or whatever, like the Greek soldiers or Roman soldiers that kind of come in and they like kind of run in with their swords and they take like wide swings at you and that sort of thing, and the skeletons kind of jab at you. It's quite a lively game, and I can totally see why you would have sat down with this game and been like, wow, this is really great, this is really cool, this is like, your Commodore 64 is blaring this out at me, that's great. Tax, you are aware of the other versions of this game. Do you want to explain just a little bit about maybe what those are doing differently?
Okay, so there's a number of parts. The main thing that's different are the graphics, and as Cal said, as you correctly said, most of them are actually a downgrade. The most notable part are the ZX Spectrum and NES ports. So they ported this to the ZX Spectrum and then from there to the NES, and they changed the main character to Conan, which doesn't really change that much, except your character is now almost naked.
And it is Conan.
Yeah, and the game kind of has a, I would say, like an atmosphere downgrade for the most part, because some effects are omitted and they do redraw most sprites. They don't really port them directly. So there's also H-ware ports, but mainly that they took kind of the idea of the game, but it might be a completely different engine with completely different colors. And it kind of feels like that the game was naturally developed for its original platform and no other part really manages to capture that feeling. The System 3 one looks pretty cartoonish, and with a couple of other ones, the colors don't feel quite right. They have this vibe of the like magenta, cyan DOS colors that just don't mesh quite well. But to be honest, even though some of them are a little bit easier, the NES port is a bit more manageable because the platforming is a little bit easier. At least that's what it felt like to me. I would actually say if you want to check this out, check out the original C64 version, because it is really the best one with regard to atmosphere. And because the game's so hard, atmosphere is probably the best what you will get out of this game.
Yeah, so like the concessions you'll get in the other systems aren't worth the downgrade and pretty much everything else, which is, I guess that's pretty fair. I would definitely highly recommend having a guide that tells you what you need to do if you plan to play the game, because it's just not fun to play a game for 5-10 minutes and just lose and be like, okay, well, why did I lose? And then repeatedly plow through the segments trying to figure out how you are supposed to not lose. It gets pretty frustrating.
And just in case you're concerned, the game's still going to be hard enough, even if you know exactly what to do. So no worries
about that. Oh, yeah, the easy part is, there's no easy part, really. Even like winning sword fights, if you're not used to playing the game, you're probably going to get your ass beat. Within 3 seconds of booting up the game, you're going to get your ass beat. You can get fireballs, but I think they run out, right? Like, you get a limited amount per fireball.
Yeah, you can recollect them. There's a couple of weapons that are expendable. Your sword lasts forever, and the game takes certain weapons away from you when you just leave the screen or go to the next room. But some of them, I think the dagger and the fireballs, they just have a certain amount of uses, and then that's it.
So, it is an odd one. I got to assume that the stage just knows what you're supposed to have and just gives you that. Like, there's no sort of memory between the stages, I guess, to keep the things that you had. It just assigns you a list of stuff that they think that you should have.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if this was one of those games where if you hack yourself into the second stage, you just magically have the sword.
Yeah, I would say so. I remember playing versions of the game. You can play it with a trainer if you really want. I mean, that's out there, right? It's probably the only way you'll find the C64 one. But I would still recommend playing it properly. I wouldn't play it with like invincibility or something like that. I think that's a little lame. It's not worth it. But we have to rank this one. We will have to do it. No choice
right,
now.
I'm gonna let you guys handle that. I'll just tell you if I think you're right or not.
Yeah. Also, we are going to rank, and then Bob's going to cast judgment.
Yeah, pretty
yeah.
Much.
That's I feel like that's harsh, but.
Yeah.
So the first thing we have to consider, this is one of the C64's best games, right?
It is.
Probably is not the best aged of the games around, a little bit.
As you said, it's really amazing for its time, and I think it still looks nice. It's not so on the ice by any means, but to be honest, if that had been released 3 or 4 years down the line, it wouldn't have been that special.
Yeah, it's special on the C64.
Yeah.
It still looks pretty good. Like, it kind of can sort of hold its own against the 16-bit consoles, which I think is one of the reasons it held out in popularity for some time. Well, what we have, let's look at, I think our highest ranked Commodore 64 game is Whizball at 85. I'm tempted not to put it above Whizball. That's kind of my sense of things is Whizball is, other than kind of having a weird ass like way that you actually progress through it, I think it's aged quite well. It's actually not too difficult, comparatively speaking. I don't know if I'd put this above Whizball, and we've got a like dense amount of stuff.
The one I'm looking at is Shadow of the Beast.
Oh yeah,
this game has a lot of in common with Shadow of the Beast. They're both like these cinematic platformers. They've got a lot of unique areas and assets. They both turn into a shmup in the end.
That's true. That's right. Shadow of the Beast. I completely forgot that Shadow of the Beast does that. Because Shadow of the Beast turns into a shmup
games.
And then turns back into a not shmup. Remember? It does that.
It does, yeah.
You have to fight a giant foot at the end. This game has a much better ending.
That is true,
I would put it above Shadow of the Beast just for that alone, honestly.
Well, for the music as well. The Shadow of the Beast has okay music.
Right.
But that's true. This game's
not so good. But both of them were kind of amazing. Flashback.
I don't think it's quite as good as Flashback, I'll say that.
Really? I personally would put it above Flashback.
Mm. How come?
I would not put it above Flashback for overall quality, but for kind of ambition. And as kind of a C64 ambassador, I might put it above that.
Well, I guess with Flashback, I don't think Flashback actually does much better. Like, considering that it has plenty of time to be a better game, and its inventory puzzles are not really any better, and Flashback has a horrible ending sequence. Like, just the longest, most, like, frustrating alien planet deal, which you didn't have to do. Whereas, you know, this game, I like that it becomes the shmup. I think that's pretty good. It adds like a nice like sort of finale feel to it.
Small detail. While your character is in shmup mode, he's sitting with his legs crossed in some sort of like zen mode.
Yes, he is.
That allows him to float. That's pretty cool. They didn't have to do it, but they did.
He becomes like a god. Like that, he transcends. If you understand, the classical Western histories, you become unto a god, I think is the message of this game. Pretty confident that's where it's going with that. I do think it's like kind of just an interesting one. Which come to shove, I would probably say it's more worthwhile to play this one than Flashback. I think that's kind of like my point. Out of This World is better than both of them, but Out of This World is not on there. Another World is not.
That is true.
Available.
Mm-hmm.
Let's have a look.
Is this, to be honest, I would probably put this below Captain Blood.
Okay,
all right.
I can feel that.
Below Captain Blood. That's in the right area anyway. Is this better or worse than Todd's Adventures in Slime World?
Oh, Cal's not gonna let you get away with that, I don't think.
Yeah, that's why I'm bringing it up now. So
I have been Of course, I could see Todd's Adventure in Slime World.
I can actually finish Slime World, so I want to put
Todd's Adventure in Slime World is a better game. Really.
Yeah. Okay. I think I would put it maybe below Techromancer, but maybe above Splatterhouse.
I'm trying to figure out with Splatterhouse, because Splatterhouse has actually got a lot of bullcrap in it, which reminds me just a little bit of this game.
This is the arcade version. It has.
Yeah.
I would say what makes this one here better than Splatterhouse is that Splatterhouse is ultimately just kind of a beat 'em up. I mean, it does have the like hammer horror aspect, but I would say that Myth does more.
Okay.
I mean, it's not that much better. It's just one spot above it, so I think that's fair.
We'll put it above Splatterhouse, also because I hate putting games that are really, really similar next to each other, so I would rather not be directly above Flashback. Above Splatterhouse is pretty fair to me, because frankly, there's that one bit where you fight the maniac with the chainsaw in Splatterhouse. Hate that so much. It's so cheap. It's like the entire cheapness of this game crammed into like 2 seconds. You know the bit I'm talking about? Yeah. Anyone remember in Splatterhouse?
Is it the one where everybody juggles the shotgun?
Yeah, you gotta like juggle the boss by glitching out the game, kind of, in order to not die.
Yeah, that's a bad sign.
I don't like that. I thought it was like, is that seriously how you're supposed to beat it? Like, break the game? This game feels like you're breaking it, but it doesn't break. It's going at 194 above Splatterhouse and below the arcade homage robot fighting game, Techromancer. I would have had a hard time putting this above Tecromancer. Tecromancer is so good. It really is. It
really is.
It's so, like, lively. But this is a great one if you're umming and ahhing about the Commodore 64. You know, Whizball, Myth, there's at least one more game that I probably can't remember at the moment, but check those three out. They're worth looking at.
That's all for this episode. Special thanks goes out to our lovely co-hosts and compatriots, our booking agent Jeff Rude, our theme song MC Norm, check him out at Normally Retro on Twitter, and our technical assistant, video editor, and scriptwriter Ed Burns. You can support this podcast by making a small monthly donation at patreon.com/HG101. I know, I did. By subscribing to the HG101 YouTube channel, and by following at GC9X and at HG_101 on Twitter. You can also hang out with us at our Discord channel. It's at bit.ly/HG Discord. But most importantly, help us spread the love of games by getting on iTunes, subscribing to HG101, and giving us a 5-star review. Do it because you like us and you want us to succeed. Until next time, keep keeping it real.